the Soho Insider podcast with my colleague, Dr. Radek, who's with me here. Jerry, welcome to the Insider podcast.
Thanks, glad to be here.
Yeah, so, you know, I'm wondering, you know, we're in a very interesting landscape in 2025. A lot is happening in the field that's keeping us away from the science of it all. But before we jump into this, you know, I just wanted to get your take on all the wonderful changes you've seen in your career, you know, in CML specifically, and in you know, blood cancers in general. You've been in Seattle now for over 2.5 decades, you know, if I remember correctly. So
decades, actually. I started the first time I went onto an oncology transplant unit was when I was a second year resident in the summer as an elective. That would be about 1984 is when I first. So things have come a long way. I mean, it's you know, clinically I'm a transplant, right? So and then lab wise, I run a couple of molecular biology labs, but in the clinical side of it, I just saw a patient today who was talking to her about this. You know, when I started off doing transplants, let's say 40 years ago, all the patients I had, all the leukemia patients I had, were all younger than I was, because you couldn't survive a transplant. It was a young person's game. The last time I was out here and doing outpatient transplant with a service of like 40 to 60 patients, a quarter of the patients were older than I am now. So that's how much the skew in the population has done. And it's, you know, there's so many facets to it, right? It's all, mostly supportive care, right? When we first started doing this, we didn't have any antiviral drugs. Well, we didn't have any cyclovir, for God's sakes. No antifungals to speak of, you know, it was just, things were just so different. So that's been a huge advance. And then, you know, in my particular little corner of the world in CML, you know, when I started, the average life expectancy was around, you know, 6-7 years, right? Because everyone, they didn't have a transplant, which is a tiny minority of patients with CML in those days could get a transplant. You know, you eventually went to blast crisis and died, right? And then so, and now with the tyrosine kinases, you know, the average life expectancy of a patient with CML chronic phase is the same as the normal population. So, you know, it's just that's unbelievable how much this has changed.
Well, that's, you know, that is fascinating. And I, you know, it's actually, you know, the imatinib story that got me interested in oncology. I'm originally from Pakistan, and I was in med school back in the late 90s when the story started to emerge.
Yeah.
And that's what, you know, convinced me, hey, you know, oncology is where it's at, and that's what, you know, we need to do. So, but it's been an outstanding story of precision medicine, essentially. But, you know, where do you see the challenges, you know, despite coming this far and you know, CML potentially, you know, turning into essentially a chronically managed condition with a pill.
Right. I think, you know, in countries that are affluent, the real problem, I think, right now in CML is this whole issue of who can actually be discontinued from therapy. Because, you know, we originally thought that people would have to be, if it's really a stem cell, that there'd always be a reservoir of CML cells and you'd have to take this drug for life. Now it looks like for people who get a great response after a number of years,
yep,
they can discontinue therapy, half of them will relapse and they'll have to go back on therapy, but half of them won't. That's really quite a, so trying to understand who those people are has obviously a major impact. But I think if you look globally, the issue with CML is that most of the CML in the world is in, you know, developing countries, right? And they can't afford a drug, they can't afford testing and the like. And I think that's the real challenge. And there are some inroads made. You know, the group I work with here at the Max Foundation, you know, has an operation where they can, if they identify patients with CML in countries that don't have the available resources, they'll get free drug for life. I think that originally Novartis agreed to do that with Max because they figured they'd never be able to do it. So it was kind of, kind of an idle gesture. But they're taking care of, you know, upwards of 60, 80,000 patients worldwide now. And a couple of years ago, we looked at the data in their program. And if you're on this program, you know, and you are getting drug, your survival is the same as if you had CML in Seattle.
Mm.
It just goes to show the power of, if we can kind of use some of this, these new drugs, and figure out a way to get them out to, you know, the vast majority of patients who don't have access to this kind of stuff in the world, you know, it'll work. We can make an impact. We can, you know, bring what we learned here to the rest of the world. And I think that's really where I see the challenge is where we have to go.
And do you feel that in addition to drug access and cost, you know, you mentioned diagnostics, right? So I would have imagined that the cost of diagnostics, you know, over the last, you know, 2.5-3 decades should have come down. It's certainly coming down for even the whole genome sequencing platform. So what do you feel are the barriers from a global standpoint?
There's a lot of obstacles, right? So even just electricity, right? So we working with Cepheid, we've gotten out instruments and cartridges to places around the world. But when we work with those countries, you know, many of their runs have to be redone and the like because the electricity goes out, right? And so we and others are trying to devise types of equipment that can be done without molecular testing, without electricity. It's a bit of a hurdle, but technically it's doable. Some of the resources, you know, you mentioned sequencing. Even though sequencing costs come down, it's exceedingly complex. Machines are expensive, they break. The bioinformatics is hard, right? It's right now, I think it's probably not scalable. There are ways now that we and others are showing where you can take samples from around the world, take dried blood, put them on spots, send that by snail mail, and you can still actually recover enough sample to do complex genetic testing. So, you know, there may be ways that we can think about in around the world putting sort of hubs of expertise, and then, you know, and then bring samples in from everywhere to get tested in kind of a standardized way. But so I think, you know, that's kind of a logistic thing that could be utilized so that we can start kind of at hubs and then move the technology out as it's developed.
So let me ask you this question. So, you know, again, thinking about the global CML care, what are the opportunities, say, in the next 20, 25 years to make sure that we have equitable care and equivalent outcomes for patients?
Right now, the major obstacles are, I think, really financial. How to fund this is really quite difficult. You know, the drug companies have given drug, that's one part of it, but when you talk about the logistics of actually then distributing drug, getting AE reporting in, doing molecular diagnostics and the like, you know, there's certainly not a clear grant funding mechanism to do that. So most of that has to come out of the kindness of people's hearts right now, because, you know, obviously the governments can't afford it. Our government isn't willing to do it. So I think the main.
No, that is, funding. Speaking of that, I think you raise a very important point, right? So it's the willingness to actually invest in those communities and have that access. I do feel that there are a lot of emerging economies that can actually manufacture drug at a fraction of a cost. And I think that's a major opportunity. And there, you know, these emerging economies are probably going to dominate, you know, this field, especially if we embark on the arduous journey that our current administration is taking us through. So I wanted to talk to you a little bit about that, Jerry. What are your thoughts? You know, where are we going? You know, where did we go wrong?
That is going to be a lot longer conversation than a podcast. but I But I certainly think that as a culture, as a government, we've lost our imagination. We've you know, it's just everything changes, and trying to basically reel back everything and put us back in the 1950s or whatever, that's just never going to work, right? And so one of the things that we have in this country that's, you know, not, I wouldn't say unique, but we have a lot of opportunities for education and discovery, and to basically give up our edge of having fantastic institutions that can do basic discovery is just, you know, it's not shooting ourselves in the foot, it's shooting ourselves in the head. I'm not a social scientist. I don't know where the distrust for expertise and everything, you know, ended up being. But somehow being educated and being elite is now a bad thing, right? Which is kind of weird. You know, you think about it, like if you had, you know, a brain tumor, would you want to go to elite neurosurgeon or a mediocre neurosurgeon? Probably elite. You know, if you could run a soccer franchise and you had the chance of being the manager of an elite, you know, group or a Bush League group, what would it be?
I think we have to, you know, just make sure that we stay true to what we signed up for years ago and continue to advocate for that. And that's the only way, you know, out of this. But I agree, you know, the whole rhetoric has kind of you know, changed, and you know, we need to make sure that you know, our voices continue to be heard, and advocacy is going to be very important moving forward.
Whenever I did stupid things as a kid, my mom would always tell me, "God gave you a brain, use it." So I think that's what we need to do collectively. We need to you know, use our brains and use our hearts and start thinking about creatively how to do good things for people.
No, I agree, Jerry. Thank you so much. This was a fun, fascinating conversation with you, and I'm sure that you know, the theme for most of the podcast this year will come back to that main issue that all of us are facing on the research front in our institution. So thank you for your insights and views today.
All right, thanks very much.